Hacking Your ADHD, part of the ADHD Rewired Podcast Network. I'm your host, William Kerr, and I have ADHD. On this podcast, I dig into the tools, tactics, and best practices to help you work with your ADHD brain. Hey team, this week I'm talking with Natalie Liu about her book, The Joy of Saying No. Natalie is the author of the popular relationship and self-esteem blog, Baggage Reclaim, as well as the host of the Baggage Reclaim Sessions podcast. With ADHD, we can often end up as people pleasers, always putting other people's needs above our own. And while being helpful is a great trait, we also need to make sure we're taking time for ourselves as well. In our conversation today, Natalie and I discuss how to work on getting out of people pleasing and work on setting up boundaries to help keep us on track for what we really want to be doing. If you'd like to follow along on the show notes page, you can find that at hackingyouradhd.com/136. This episode is brought to you by Athletic Greens. I started taking AG1 because it's hard to make sure that I'm getting in all the nutrition I need every day. My ADHD can make it hard for me to remember that I need to eat my meals, let alone making sure that those meals are healthy. With AG1, I have the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. One scoop of AG1 has 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source ingredients, probiotics, and adaptogens to help me start my day right. It doesn't matter how tired I feel, I know I can at least do that in the morning. I love how easy it is to mix in, and that has made it a staple of my morning routine. And having those steps already decided in the morning just makes my morning routine go that much easier. Right now is the time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just one scoop and a cup of water every day. That's it. No need for a million different pills and supplements to look out for your health. And to make this easy for you, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free one-year supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/ADHD. Again, that is athleticgreens.com/ADHD to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. And before we get started, I also wanted to let you know about the ADHD Rewired Coaching and Accountability Group's upcoming registration event for their spring 2023 season on Thursday, March 23rd at 10 a.m. Pacific and 1 p.m. Eastern. To register, just go to coachingrewired.com and get your name on the interest list by clicking the teal button. This podcast is part of the greater ADHD Rewired Network, but if you haven't heard of them, let me give you a little insight about them. The Coaching and Accountability Groups are an intensive 10-week-long program where you meet 3 times a week for an hour to help coach you through the ups and downs of ADHD life. This season will be going from March 30th through June 8th, so if you've been thinking about this program, now is the time to try and sign up. While a lot of coaching is structured around learning how to do things like better manage your time, the group also explores the emotional and more cerebral side of things that really make a difference, because we all know that just buying a new calendar isn't going to be the game changer that we want it to be. So if you're interested now or you've been thinking about it for a while, go sign up and get some more information at the upcoming registration events on Thursday, March 23rd at 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. To register, just go to coachingrewired.com. That link again is coachingrewired.com. All right, keep on listening to find out how you can reclaim your time by saying no. So your book is The Joy of Saying No, which I love the idea of because it's something I need to embrace more in my own life. But could you tell us a little bit more about the book before we get into anything?
Yeah, absolutely. So The Joy of Saying No, you know, the subtitle is A Simple Plan to Stop People Pleasing, Reclaim Boundaries, and Say Yes to the Life You Want. And really, it's a book about how you can use saying no as a way to reclaim yourself from painful habits. You can use no as a way to actually elevate and improve your relationships, to feel much better about yourself. You can actually use saying no authentically. So saying no when you need, want to, and should, as opposed to saying yes because you're trying to, you know, please everyone or trying to avoid conflict and criticism. But you can use no as a way to practice genuine self-care. You know, I think, and understandably as a society, when we think about, oh, how can I heal myself from my emotional baggage, or how can I heal these problematic habits in my life? The obvious default that a lot of people go to is therapy. And I'm not knocking therapy, but what happens is a lot of people see it as, well, I have to go to therapy and then it's going to take like years. But what this book is saying is part of the reason, well, the only reason really why we're not saying no when we need, want to, and should is because of our emotional baggage. So when we allow ourselves to start saying no more, then we can immediately start to feel the positive impacts in our life and we can use no as a way to heal our emotional baggage.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. And also just the idea that these are patterns that we have in our life and we have the ability to interrupt these patterns. We're not chained to them. We can do more than just what we already know.
Yeah, absolutely. We're not set in stone. Mm-hmm. Like a lot of what we do today as adults are what we have continued to do without question that we've actually learned in childhood. And these habits are coping and survival mechanisms, but they are maladaptive. We've received messages about what it means to be good and what it means to be bad and, you know, what makes a better human, what allows you to be happy and successful. And adulthood is about unlearning all of the unproductive and harmful messaging that we've picked up along the way so that we can become more of who we really are. And I think it is easy for us to understandably sometimes overcomplicate, you know, sort of breaking these cycles and breaking these habits. But actually boundaries is everything in life. And so if we can learn how to say yes and no more authentically, we will find that we feel better within ourselves. We find that our relationships feel better. We find that our sort of work, you know, our relationship of work improves. We'll find that everything in life improves.
Yeah, absolutely. And I love the way you used maladaptive there, because it also implies that, yeah, we adapted to this probably as a defense mechanism mm-hmm. or something. And so it was not originally something where it was not originally negative for us, but it has become negative in our life.
Yeah, absolutely. People pleasing is a misappropriation of our good qualities. So we invest our good qualities in sometimes, yeah, what might be the wrong people, but also in the wrong situations. And essentially, we go around doing what, for all intents and purposes, are often what could be seen as quote unquote good things, but for the wrong reasons. And we do it because when we're kids, we try to figure out what it is that we need to be and do to gain attention, affection, approval, love, and validation. But also, we receive messages about, well, what does good mean? And what does bad mean? So we also try to figure out, oh, how can I avoid conflict, criticism, rejection, disappointment, and actually abandonment? Because as children, we depend on, you know, our parents and caregivers for our survival. And so we have learned these survival coping strategies as a means of like helping out and being good. And it's also how we've learned to feel needed, you know, purposeful and worthy. But the maladaptive thing is key. We're not supposed to still be doing this stuff in adulthood. And so what people-pleasing does is it ends up being like a mask, a costume that blocks us, not just from being who we really are. So we end up pretending to be somebody that we're not, but it also blocks intimacy in our relationships. There's so many of us that are in careers that actually we don't really want to be in. We're doing it because we think it pleases our parents or because it's what we think is high status and will show that we are happy and successful. There's a lot of us who are hiding aspects of ourselves because we feel that it's not palatable to the people around us. And of course, this creates misery in our lives eventually.
Yeah, I mean, I can see how that relates with ADHD so strongly, too, because I've seen estimates ADHD children will get corrected like 10,000 times more than their neurotypical peers. And so it's that avoiding that correction, being like, how can I make the adult happy? And then that just, we translate that to all our other relationships.
Wow. Yes. I mean, I felt that so strong. I mean, yes, because children are constantly receiving signals about what is acceptable, what's not acceptable. And so if you find that you're being corrected that much more than your peers, that's sending a signal of some sort to you. And you can start to build an identity around that. And next thing you know, you're an adult who actually believes that that's what your identity is, that you're somehow difficult, or that you have to sort of tamp yourself down in this respect, and you've got to try that much harder. It's like, okay, well, if I find that particular thing difficult, I remember what it was like to have somebody telling me off repeatedly. So I'm just going to put in like 100 times the effort, because then maybe I won't court disapproval. Then maybe I will be okay.
Yeah, of course. That's not how it works.
Not at all. Not at all. Like these as children, we can be understandably simplistic about how the world works. So if we experience something that we don't like the look and feel of, we will somehow, as a kid, we will always find a way to make ourselves responsible for that. It's like, oh, it's me. I'm not good enough. I should have tried harder. But also, when we start to get messages about, well, what are people getting strokes, you know, rewards for, praise? Where do they tend to get approval? But also, where do they tend to get disapproval? We can start to do things to get more of the good stuff and avoid more of the bad stuff. And next thing you know, it's just become a way of life. So a very classic example of this is that, you know, I've spoken to a lot of people who they grew up in a home where, for instance, they have a sibling who got into a lot of trouble, who maybe was getting a lot of attention from teachers. You know, they could be that kid who was getting like 10 times more the level of attention than, say, others. So then they thought to themselves, oh, I don't want to be like my sibling attracting like that trouble. Look at my parents, so busy with that. Okay, so what I will do is I'm going to make it my job to be good and to be quiet and to never be difficult. And so they build their identity around that, even though actually they didn't need to. But it's what we do as kids.
Yeah. Kids are just looking for patterns and following them, and mm-hmm. they're doing their best, but they're still developing. They don't know all of life yet.
Yeah. And I think what's sad, I think, is, I mean, there's a lot that's sad about it, but, you know, a child only has to have, you know, kind of a repetition of a particular comment, you know, a couple of times from somebody where maybe the person has said, or you're difficult, or you don't concentrate well, or you don't understand this, or you're not clever at this, or don't do that, you're not good at that, you're not creative, you're not this, you're not that. And next thing you know, there are 20-something, 30-something, 40-something, 50-something plus person who believes that they are not clever, or that they're not able to finish tasks. Like, for instance, I remember hearing from somebody who said, you know, I'm just not a finisher. Mm-hmm. And I thought, okay, so tell me more. Like, who told you that you're not a finisher? Well, you know, people say I'm not a finisher. Like, my dad says I'm not a finisher, and other people said I'm not a finisher. So I said, okay, well, tell me about your life. So, okay. There were certain things that she hadn't finished. Welcome to the club. But there were lots of things that she had finished. And I said, look, by your definition, I'm not a finisher either, because I have various things I kind of started to get into, and then, I don't know, went off to something else, or I kind of lost interest, or whatever it is that's at a certain level. Does that mean I'm not a finisher, even though I have all these other things that I finished? And she was like, oh, I spent my whole life believing like I'm not a finisher, that I'm just a starter. But then she collected this evidence in her life that completely disproved that theory. She's like, okay, yes, yeah, so there's some stuff I haven't finished. Who hasn't?
Yeah, I mean, that's the way with ADHD, and so many things with, we just build our identity around things that we hear. I see it in my own kids too all the time, where they're like, they'll like say something, I'm like, where did you get that idea? Mm. And it's being like, okay, now we have to work on, like, that's not true. My 7-year-old daughter would be like, oh, you know, nobody likes me. And I'm like,
oh, wow.
Very not true. As a parent, that's really painful. I mean, like, I really like you. You have friends that really like you. And
yeah, but there's this specific person or group of people who they think don't like them. And that has become, nobody likes me. I remember my eldest daughter saying pretty much the same thing as well. And it's heartbreaking because you're like, I don't want you to feel that way. You want to protect them.
Yeah. And it's part of our brains just attaching on to the negative. We can have, you know, the 1,000 positive comments, but then the one negative one, we're like, oh my God.
Yeah, totally. I remember that from, I think it was Madonna was attributed with it. I think it must've been back in the 80s. And she said, you know, you could have 100 people and 99 of them are like, you're amazing. You're brilliant. That album is amazing. And one person is like, that album is rubbish. And you will obsess about that one person and totally forget like the other 99 who were like, I love what you do.
It's maddening when you think about it, because you're like, why can't I focus on this positive side of things? But I mean, there is, of course, like an evolutionary side to things where like, if you know which berries are the poison ones, like which ones make you feel sick, you're not going to eat those again. But that we don't live in that kind of time anymore.
No. And the funny thing is, we don't live in that kind of time, but actually we're still pretty primitive in a number of respects. And so like, you know, hundreds of years ago, but actually not even that far back. I mean, in some cultures, it would still be happening now. There was this sense of, okay, you must go and marry this person from the other tribe or from the other family, because this will help us to advance the family. And if you don't do this, then we will be basically isolated from the group, from the community. So it was this sort of, we won't belong. And humans desperately want to belong. They want acceptance. So that means that paradoxically, they fear rejection.
Yeah.
And so even though we're not necessarily in that same place, obviously culturally there can be differences, but so generally speaking, we're not in that place where it's like, oh, we need to marry you off and with some cattle, you know, for the survival of the family. On some level, we still have this like, oh my gosh, if I don't do what others expect of me, even if it's completely unreasonable for them or us to expect it of ourselves, it's like, I'm not going to survive. I'm going to be cast out. So that's that primitive feeling like danger, danger. I am putting myself in mortal danger.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's a big root of why we do all that people pleasing is like, if I don't make everyone in the room happy, then I'm going to be cast out and no one's going to talk to me. And that's just that primitive fear.
Yeah. And realistically speaking, you know, I say to people, like, after you've said no, like open your front door or look out of your window. Has the world gone up in smoke? Has Armageddon happened? Is the world still turning? Yeah, absolutely. But if we don't do that, it's really easy to just get into our feelings and the catastrophizing and be like, oh my gosh, it's really terrible. But actually, if we get a grounding on where am I? What is happening? Am I being savaged by wild animals? Have I been cast out of the community? But it is, you're so right that the people pleasing has been our survival. You know, something I talk about in the book is how if you're not a child right now, then you were raised in the age of obedience. That's not to say that there isn't still some emphasis on obedience, but for hundreds of years, the interacting, disciplining, communicating with children really centered on making children as excessively compliant as possible. You know, children should be seen and not heard. Mm-hmm. Do as I say, not as I do. I'll give you something to cry about. You know, what will the neighbors think? You know, all that type of thing. And as a result, we have learned that the most important thing is to be compliant. So this has actually disassociated us from our bodies. So imagine now, like when you, even just for so many of us, like as a society, having that where it's like, be compliant. Oh, if you feel something, you're being rude. If you don't want to do the same thing as me, you're being rude, you're being disobedient. So we're raised to be disassociated from our bodies, disassociated from, you know, our boundaries. Now, throw in then, for instance, that you have ADHD.
Mm-hmm.
And there is this, you must comply. So you're already now disassociated from your feelings. But then you have the sense that some of the things that you do don't go the same way for you as they do for other people. But then you don't want to appear disobedient. you don't want to attract any more negative attention. So you just keep dismissing and dismissing and dismissing yourself, which is why there are so many people, you know, so many adults who are being, you know, diagnosed as ADHD much later in life.
Yeah. I mean, people are realizing that, oh, this is the explanation behind why I'm doing all of these things in my life. And it's often super eye-opening to them. They're like, oh my God, this explains everything. Like, I've gotten a number of emails recently with people that were like, hey, my kid recently got diagnosed. And then apparently I do all those same things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That is really, really common where they take the kit and then it's like, yeah. Oh, actually, I mean, there's, you know, we are at some here in England since the pandemic. It has, I don't know what it's like in the States, but there is a massive backlog for, it's like it's in crisis state where they won't accept private diagnostics. So that you have to kind of go through the government's council designated people. So there is on average a 2.5 Ooh. Year long waiting list. And so it was flagged to us that one of our daughters, this was, you know, sort of in the first year of the pandemic, you know, potentially has ADHD. And it's, you know, again and again, it's come up and it's just been so difficult to get really anywhere with, I mean, we basically filled out the forms like 2 years ago, never heard a thing again. It just like fell like through the cracks. So now we're at the point where it's like, actually, we're probably just going to have to go private and hope and pray that they will accept that. And I think it's more for her to have access to an understanding of what is going on and why, so she can work with rather than against herself, but also so that we can support her with that. And so that, because it is helping to make sense, because of course you can get very frustrated yeah. with yourself. I mean, and that's not just kids. You know, I have a really good friend of mine. She found out she had ADHD. What are we in 2023? So that's 2021, I think she did. And she said, actually, she just needed to take time to, because it was like a world shifting where suddenly, you know, 40 something years of her life, suddenly a whole load of stuff that had been explained as something else was suddenly making sense and entirely. And she said it was a lot to sort of make sense of, but it also, as soon as she was willing to accept that, it allowed her to get the help and the support that she needed. It allowed her to actually, as I said, work with herself yeah. rather than against herself. So they're trying to force herself into being like neurotypical.
Yeah. Oftentimes we're just like, okay, this is the solution I have to do because this is the way everyone else does. But then we get this new information like, oh, doing it that way is the worst possible way for my brain.
Yeah. Yeah, it was the sense of, and I do think, again, it is this sort of legacy of being of a society over, you know, hundreds of years, who's sort of had this mentality of fit into the herd, people are this way. You know, there was a time, like I'm 45, approaching 46. I can remember as a kid, and I'm right-handed, but I have a brother who's left-handed. So I remember when being left-handed used to just attract all sorts of weird, negative, completely inappropriate comments. You know, I haven't heard anything like that now since, but it was completely normal sort of back in the day. So there was this real, oh, it's normal to think this way, to do it this way. It's not. We're not all supposed to do everything the same way. Our brains work differently. Yeah. And we're supposed to allow them to be different. And I think it is the whole people-pleasing society and being like, oh, society says I should do things this way if I am to be a happy and successful and quote-unquote normal person. And so it's like, even though that isn't working for me, I should just keep trying to force myself to do that because that is what society expects of me and I must please society. And it's like, yeah. No, we don't need to do that.
This is making me think about what it actually means to do people-pleasing too, because I feel like a lot of people get that kind of confused where they're like, oh, yeah. It's just being nice to everyone or something.
Yeah, that's a very, very common sort of misunderstanding about people pleasing. People pleasing is the suppressing of our needs, desires, expectations, feelings, and opinions. The suppressing of ourselves to prioritize everybody else's needs, desires, expectations, feelings, and opinions. And we do it to get that stuff we talked about earlier, the attention, affection, approval, love, and validation, but also to avoid negative consequences. Now, some people pleasing, you could say, is about, oh, it's being nice to everybody. So it's telling people what they want to hear. And it's always trying to make people feel good and never making them feel uncomfortable and doing what they want. But the whole thing with people pleasing is that on some level, you do things not because you want to, but because it's what you think is expected of you. And it is that thought process of like, I have to do this or else, you know, I'm going to have problems that can just wreak havoc in our lives. It can seem so innocent. It's like, oh my gosh, like what's so wrong with like being generous and kind? Well, the thing is, no, there isn't anything wrong with being generous and kind, but being generous and kind is different from I'm going to do this because I'm afraid that if I don't do this, then you are going to hurt me. You're going to reject me, that you're not going to want me, or I'm not going to get what I want. I think that's something that a lot of people pleasers struggle with as well, is people pleasing is like creating a debt and expecting other people to pay it off. So you sacrifice yourself. You don't take care of your own needs, desires, expectations, feelings, and opinions. You basically take on these roles. So, you know, we talked about sort of how people pleasing is like a mask or a costume. Mm-hmm. So you play these roles in your relationship, and maybe you're the listener or the helper or the advice giver or the scapegoat or the overachiever or the underachiever or whatever it is. But we do that because of what we hope we will get back in return. That is people pleasing. So lots of people want to help others. They want to be loving, but they don't do it because they're trying to cover up underlying feelings of low self-worth. They don't do it on autopilot. They do it with consideration of themselves. And they're not doing it because of what they hope they will get back. And that is the people-pleasing. In the book, I talk about there's 5 styles of people-pleasing. And this is where you can really clearly see where it shows up. And those 5 styles are gooding, efforting, avoiding, saving, and suffering. So the names in and of themselves are telling you something about the way in which the person goes about pleasing. Gooding means that you will use trying to look good, you know, being good. So I'm a good person. I'm a good Christian. I'm a good mm-hmm. daughter. I'm a good this. Or I have really good intentions. Right? That's what you will use to try to please people, but you will also, that'll be your identity. Some people, and I would fit into this one, would be the efforting. So you're about effort. You have it's wanting to be the best, doing the best, giving 100%, you know, always being seen to be making an effort. It wouldn't be enough to look good to others. It's like, I've got the receipts, the effort receipts to prove this. And because I've put in the effort, you should be pleased with me and I shouldn't receive any negative consequences. Avoiding is where we'll avoid discomforting others, saying something that we think, oh, that might rock the boat a bit. So there's a lot of avoiding conflict, but it's also that sort of blending in. So it's like, I like what you like. I want to do what you want to do, even if actually you really don't. And so it's going along to get along, even though that means you can walk yourself into a whole lot of problems. The saving is the helping, fixing, rescuing, overgiving. And I think this particular group of people, you know, the people who would really identify with this, feel really uncomfortable with this because they're like, well, what's wrong with giving? Mm-hmm. But actually, they need to feel needed. And they sacrifice themselves, which means they often attach themselves to people who they sometimes see as like a pet project, who will sort of need them more so than others. And the hope is, oh, look at everything I'm doing for you. Why would you leave me? Why would you criticize me? And then suffering is this whole idea of, well, the more you suffer, the better it makes you as a person. And so it's like, I bleed for you. I'll give up my boundaries for you. And that's the way that some people try to please others. And Well, the reason why I came up with these styles of people pleasing is for exactly what you said. A lot of people think, well, what's the problem with people pleasing? Or isn't it just being nice? But when you hear what those styles of people pleasing are, you go, oh, now I see what this is all about. So look, nobody's knocking you for putting in effort or being good. But if you don't have boundaries with it, if you're doing it because of what you think will happen to you, if you don't, then that's not a good reason to do it.
Absolutely. It's so easy to fall into that thing of like, I'm going to do this and then that person's going to like me, or, you know, just some sort of reciprocation that they didn't sign on to. You're creating expectations that don't exist within their realm too.
Amen, William. Amen. You have hit the nail on the head. It's you're entering people into unspoken contracts they didn't agree to. And then what happens is, and this is the calling card of the people pleaser, whether we think it or we actually say it, it's like, after everything I've done for you, or after everything I've done for them. And this lets us know that we have been people pleasing, but it's on some level, we're not saying the things that we truly need to say. We're maybe hiding our needs and we're going along with things or whatever it is that we're up to, because we think, oh, well, that person will like me more, or they'll want to make me into their girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, or, you know, they'll pick me the next time they want to pick somebody to do something. And then when we're not picked, well, but I've done all the things. I've been so pleasing. I've been so good. And it hurts us. Like, we feel so frustrated with ourselves. But we don't realize how the people pleasing is disingenuous. We're not doing things because we want to, but because we're afraid of what will happen if we don't, or because we're trying to get something in return.
Yeah. And we're not telling people what we want. And it's yeah. It's impossible for people to give you what you want if they don't know what it is.
Yeah. We just think, oh, let me Jedi mind trick people with all my good deeds. And eventually they'll be like, ooh, look at all these good deeds that this person is doing. Okay, I'll do this. Because we think that that is easier than coming out straight and saying, I need this, or I like this, or I am that. So instead, we'll just drop hints without pleasing. And of course, humans are self-involved creatures. So a lot of the time, people miss the hints, or they take advantage of the fact that we're so willing to sort of lay ourselves out with the pleasing.
Yeah, absolutely. Just, and they might not even be doing it consciously. It's like, oh, that person will always volunteer to do this. So, well, we don't have to look for anyone else.
Yeah. You know, a common complaint is, you know, in the average office, you know, for those places where people are going back into the office, there'll be somebody who is fuming privately because they're the one who always cleans out the microwave, or they're the ones who organize like the collection for the birthday card or whatever it might be, or the one who always stays behind or is asked to fill in stuff. But the thing is, and I get, like, I understand why they might feel like sort of taken advantage of. But one of the things that we have to face when we're feeling that way and we are that person is we are not making it clear that we don't want to do stuff. And sometimes we're just like going ahead and doing it because it's like, oh, well, it's me. It falls to me. But people don't know where they stand with us until we turn around and say, actually, no, I can't do that today. Somebody else will have to do it. And sometimes there's a control element in it as well. In fact, often where it's like, we don't want to do it, but it's like, oh, well, if I don't do it, nobody else is going to do it. Or if I don't do it, it's not going to be done right. And it's like, no, leave it alone. Let somebody else do it.
Yeah, I also see aspects of being, we won't ask for what we want in those situations because we don't see the worth, our own worth in it. We go, if people can't acknowledge what we want, then it's not worth asking for.
That's such a painful place to be in because it becomes a vicious cycle. Because on some level, we believe that if we are doing all the right things and we're doing all the good deeds, that people will go, oh, where are we? I will go and meet their needs. So we haven't articulated anything specific, but we're like, but surely they'll figure it out, because we imagine it, because we're running around thinking about everybody else's feelings and their needs, sort of projecting onto that, that other people will do that with us. And so then it becomes, oh, wow, I feel really neglected, even though I'm doing all of these things for this person. So then it's like, well, obviously they just don't see the value in me. I'm not good enough. And it's like, no, that's totally not what it is. But it becomes this vicious cycle because it's then, but if they valued me, they would do more things for me and they would meet my needs, but my needs aren't being met and they still want me to do things. So they clearly don't value me yet. And so round and round and round we go.
Hard place to be in. And, but it also is hard to get out of. I see. Like people don't see, they're like, well, how do I stop? Because they're stuck in that mindset. If they don't say yes to these things, then they're stuck, but they don't see how they can say no.
Yeah, I think a lot of the reason why people struggle with people pleasing is because they really over-identify with the people pleaser identity. So it's not even necessarily that they might call it people pleasing, but it's like it's become synonymous with who they are. They don't know the difference between themselves and the people pleasing. And so then it's like, well, who would I be without this people pleasing? Like they think nobody will need me. I won't be valuable anymore. Like I won't have a purpose. And it's like, actually, who you are without the people pleasing is yourself. And so I think that there's also as well this fear that if we cut back on people pleasing, which is really what it's about, is cutting back and being more mindful about it, we fear that people will think that we're a terrible person, that suddenly we're going to be in a whole lot of conflict and we're just like, we're this bad person, which I think really underscores what a job society has done in convincing people that, you know, being pleasing and avoiding saying no is the best way to go. And so I think that's why I say in the book, like the first step in, you know, sort of reclaiming yourself on a cycle of people pleasing, figuring out how you can cut back is getting to know your people pleasing. Because of course we're going to have crossover, you know, certain things we all do, but actually, our people pleasing manifests in very, very specific ways in our lives, in specific types of situation or around specific people. Okay, yeah, sometimes you get the chronic people pleaser where it's like across the board in every situation and with every person, the people pleasing is there. But actually, for a lot of people, when they start to pay attention to where their people pleasing is showing up, they're like, oh, actually, at work, I have pretty good boundaries, but when it comes to my family and friends, I don't, or vice versa. But, or they go, actually, the thing that I get, that I struggle with is like overcommitting myself. And that, you know, that seems to be the trigger point for why I people please. And so what I recommend to people is they spend like a week just observing, compassionately observing how they spend their yes, no, and maybe. What is causing stress and strain? Like what's triggering what I call the people pleaser feelings, anxiety, resentment, frustration, overwhelm, feeling overloaded, irritation, feeling low, helpless, powerless. Notice who or what is setting off those people pleaser feelings. What patterns are you noticing about your days? And I think that intel can help you to solve for that. So a classic example I give of this is that a lot of people front load their weeks. So even if, you know, we know that not everybody works like Monday to Friday. Some people work weekends, some people work evenings and so forth. But there is this mentality that Monday is the start of a new week. And so people come into the week and they just saddle them. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Sure. I can. Because it feels like, oh, it's a new week. And then it gets to Wednesday, possibly even Tuesday, and they are exhausted already. And they're starting to feel panicky about all the things that they've committed to and, you know, what they're trying to deal with. And if we start noticing these patterns in our week, you know, where are we overcommitting? You know, one of the things I'm guilty of is I underestimate how much time it will take for me to do something. So I have to be really vigilant about that. And it is that knowing yourself, because it's really easy to, instead of knowing yourself, to judge yourself for that thing and be like, oh, I underestimate how much time it takes me to do stuff, or I don't get all of my stuff done in one day. How silly am I? But actually, if we recognize the patterns in our week and we go, okay, here's what I know works for me, and here's what I know doesn't. How can I solve for this? How can I approach my day, you know, how I go about my life in a way that supports me rather than goes against me? And so that means maybe, for instance, we're not supposed to be back, you know, booking ourselves up back to back. Maybe we're somebody who actually needs to leave some space in our day so our brain gets a chance to calm down, so we don't end up feeling overstimulated, because a knock-on effect maybe is that when we feel overstimulated, the next thing you know, that spirals, it has this domino effect. And next thing you know, it's like, oh gosh, like, why have I done this to myself again? And so it's like looking ahead, you know, something I say to people is, don't just say yes in the moment. And it's like, oh yeah, but without considering, well, what else have I got going on today? What else is going on in my life? How am I feeling? Do I have the bandwidth for it? So as in, do I have the time, the energy, the effort, so the motivation around it? Does how I'm feeling emotionally really allow for me to do this? It's like, okay, if I say yes to this today, how does this affect the rest of my week? How about I don't front load my week? And instead, when I start the week, it's like, okay, I look at the whole week, maybe even look even a bit into the week ahead. And I spread things across the week instead of piling myself up day after day and then just expecting me to pull out, you know, the ability to do all of this stuff, like pulling a rabbit out of a hat.
We can all fill our days so easily. Yeah. And one of the things I've been trying to remind myself more of is that everything I say yes to is implicitly saying no to anything else I could do during that time.
Amen. Yes, absolutely.
Because it's like, yeah, I can't do three things at, you know, lunchtime. I can have lunch or I could do something else, but I really need to have lunch. So I need to not be like booking myself over like that.
Yeah, it is that. A lot of people see no as being a dirty word, as if yes is always like clean and good. But if we don't say yes authentically, we say it resentfully, fearfully, and avoidantly. So that creates more problems than if we just said no in the first place. But also, yes and no are not separate, as you have beautifully described. What you say yes to means you say no to something else, and vice versa. A lot of people are guilty of, they don't go for, how would you say it? So here we would say like not going for a wee. You guys would say not going for a pee, right? So they skip bathroom breaks. They skip meals. They don't have lunch. They sit at their desk. They don't, you know, move around. They, you know, they work into the evening. So they eat into their sleep and relaxation and personal time. These are not good for us. Sure, we can do it occasionally, but as a way of life, like no. And so when we're saying, one of the things I say to people is how we do some things is often how we do a lot of things. So when we skip basic needs, basic functions, like going to the bathroom and having something to eat and getting sleep, that is a metaphor for how we go about meeting our needs. So it's like saying, actually, we're bottom of the pile. We dismiss ourselves. We treat ourselves like a machine. I'll just get more out of it. I'll skip lunch. I'd be like you. If I skip, you know, I can skip the odd meal here or there, but actually I am not at my best if I do not allow myself to eat. I get hangry. And when I go into that zone, the anxiety starts to kick in. I become very irritable. My brain becomes like scrambled, you know, where things just really sort of stop making sense. Not good for me. I've also found that if I have too many things going on, I start to have complete like, where I would know, oh yeah, I've got that thing today. I've got to go to that thing. I've got that appointment. But if I've had too many things going on, so I'm feeling a little overloaded and overtired, even if I'm not necessarily fully aware of it, I will have complete boom. It's deleted from my brain. And then it'll be a few hours later and I go, oh my gosh, I was supposed to be like at that thing. And then I go, oh, this is a sign that you've had too much going on.
Yeah.
Your body is literally letting you know.
also, we don't want to have our body telling us those things too, because oftentimes it's like, that's when we start dropping the ball on things, and we don't want to be doing that. So it's preemptively doing self-care for ourselves by saying no to more things.
Yeah, because when the people will say, oh, I feel like my body is letting me down, like it's not reliable. It's not letting you down. It is giving you information. And when you are not taking care of yourself, your body will send you signals. Right? I mean, a classic example I give is where you sit at your desk and you're like, okay, just like one more minute. Just one more sentence, like one more paragraph or one more thing to do. You get up and you're like, oh my gosh, if I don't sprint, I'm not going to make it to the bathroom. No. All your body signals suddenly come back online and you like start seeing stars in front of your eyes because you feel dizzy from not eating and your stomach starts gurgling and you realize like your back and your neck and your legs, everything is hurting. Your body is supposed to communicate this information to you. It is not letting you down.
Yeah. Yeah. Often we're just not paying attention.
Yeah. I think particularly in these, we might say these modern times, I think that we have sort of been geared up to pursue being as productive as possible, to keep going and going and going, you know, like the Energizer bunny. And so we think, oh, well, I don't need to pay attention to my body because it's inconvenient. No, it's not inconvenient at all. Like, totally not.
No. It's all you got.
Yeah. Your house, it's your house and you live in it. And that's where you've been in, since you were in the womb, and it's carrying you all the way through life. You need to treat it with care. Don't wait for it to break down before you actually give it some attention.
I don't have anywhere else to go.
Yeah, where would you go? Exactly. Yeah. There's nowhere for you to go.
Yeah. Well, this was a great conversation. I think people get a lot out of it. So if people want to hear more about this, about your book, or want to see more about you and your podcast and your blog, where should they go and take a look?
So I have my website, natalielu.com. Which is where you can find details of my book and the podcast, which is the Baggage Reclaim Sessions. And on social, it's Instagram. I'm at Nat Lu, NATLUE. And yeah, please buy the book, everybody.
Yeah, as much as I've gotten out of this conversation, I'm like, the book's got to be so much better. So
thank you. Thank you. Thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. And thank you for having me.
Thanks for sticking with me all the way to the end. And thanks again for Natalie for coming on the show. That was really a great conversation. Be sure to check out her new book, The Joy of Saying No, and her blog and podcast, Baggage Reclaim. But before you go, though, let's do a quick rundown of today's top tips. 1. People-pleasing is about suppressing one's needs, desires, expectations, feelings, and opinions to prioritize others' needs and avoid negative consequences. 2. By people-pleasing, we create unspoken contracts, and this can lead to frustration when the other party doesn't fulfill their end. We often drop hints instead of being direct about our needs because of our fear of rejection or negative consequences. 3. While it can be hard to say no, it is vital that we're using our no to help us set boundaries that will help curtail our people-pleasing and allow us to prioritize our own well-being. That's it. Thanks for listening. I'd love to hear what you thought of this episode. You can leave me a message over at hackingyouradhd.com/contact. You can also reach me on Twitter at hackingyouradhd, and I've also just launched a TikTok channel that you can find by searching for Hacking Your ADHD. If you'd like links or to read this episode's transcript, you can find those on the show notes page at hackingyouradhd.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, the best way is to share episodes with someone you think would get something out of it. Just click the share button on your podcast player and send your bestie the link with something like, "Hey, I love this episode of Hacking Your ADHD. I'd bet you'd get a lot out of it too." Or you can support the show through my Patreon at hackingyouradhd.com/Patreon. Sign up for the $2, $5, $10, $25, or even $50 a month level and get some great perks like monthly bonus content or early access to upcoming episodes. That's hackingyouradhd.com/Patreon. And be sure to check out all the other podcasts on the ADHD Rewired Podcast Network. For interviews with fellow ADHDers and ADHD experts, check out Eric Tiver's show, ADHD Rewired. For those of you with kids, be sure to check out Brendan Mahan's show, ADHD Essentials. And even if you don't have kids, his show is still a great resource for ADHD management. If you're interested in exploring issues of race and diversity in ADHD, be sure to check out ADHD Diversified with MJ. I also do a live Q&A with all the hosts of the ADHD Rewired Podcast Network on the second Tuesday of the month at 10:30 a.m. Pacific. If you'd like to sign up, just go to ADHDRewired.com/events. And now for your moment of dad. Why did the chicken click the PowerPoint presentation? To get to the other slide.